Welcome back to Coast AM. Once again, if you want to check out my other radio shows, 5 days a week I broadcast, you could check out my website, which is theawareshow.com. That's theawareshow.com. If you look at our website right now, you'll see that I've produced a bunch of our shows for YouTube, and I'm kind of on a mission. I'm on a rant there. If you have an opportunity to go to my YouTube channel and subscribe, it's free. It basically votes for conscious media to have a place in our world. I think just what we do here on Coast to Coast is bringing consciousness to the mainstream. And I think that companies like YouTube need to know that that has an audience. So go to my YouTube channel, The Aware Show YouTube channel, and subscribe, please, and make a vote for media with a message. All right, we will be right back with more messages. This is Lisa Gar, you're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I am Lisa Gar. My guest is Stephen Drucker. He's the author of Altered Genes, Twisted Truth, how the venture to genetically engineer our food has subverted science, corrupted government, and systematically deceived the public. We are going to calls here, and we have our callers east of the Rocky, Michael. Michael from Virginia Beach. Hi, how you doing today?
I'm doing great, Lisa, and you're doing a terrific job.
Thank you.
Stephen Drucker, would you please spell your last name for me? I got in a little late. It's Drucker. Okay, great. Steve, we know that there are religious people in this country who are very highly motivated to eat clean and healthy foods. They take a page out of the Bible, the book of Daniel, that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would not eat the king's polluted meat. And we have today churches which put a great emphasis on miraculous healing, but they don't put a great emphasis on eating clean, safe, non-genetically modified foods. So we have to somehow form a conspiracy church service.com to reach these people, these millions and millions of highly motivated religious people, to get out of this money changers, FDA-owned system that is destroying their lives, making their children and grandchildren very unhealthy, and doing all kinds of things with drugs. So I like what you're doing. Your information is incredible. I like what Lisa did with Andrew Wakefield and bringing him on this show. But here in my own town of Norfolk in Virginia Beach, where I have never been banned from any radio station in 30 years of doing what I'm doing to you, calling tonight, here, as soon as a bank came to our public radio station called J.P. Morgan and said they're going to back the station, I got banned. And the guy that did it is named Morgan Chase, J.P. Morgan Chase. So we know the financial connection. The money changers will do to us what they did to the Jews 2,000 years ago. They will sell us down the drain until they come and crucify all of our Christian men like they did to 500,000 Jews.
Let me ask Stephen. Stephen, do you know of the affiliation between media and GMO? I mean, in terms of money and GMO and ads and so forth?
The affiliation between which and GMOs, did you say?
So big media and
big media. Well, I haven't gone into. I don't. My book doesn't try to go into an extensive investigation of all of the links. But it's clear that the big media here in the United States. United States has been on the promotional side of genetic engineering. And that's just documented by the fact that they have time and again, when given the opportunity to present to the public what the FDA scientists actually said and compare that to the claims of the FDA administrators that are released to the public and showing the dichotomy, they don't do it. They just continue to state the FDA says these foods are safe. There's no dispute in the scientific community. They have chronically always presented this issue as experts versus uninformed, emotionally based consumers who don't understand the facts, instead of interviewing the well-credentialed scientists that do have concerns. So they don't bring up the fact that the FDA experts had concerns or that many other experts have concerns. So it's the way that they present it. And that in itself is circumstantial evidence that they are very reluctant to present facts that would give a bad image to genetically engineered foods.
Yeah, I do appreciate your story there, Michael, and thank you so much for sharing that, because it has to hear a real account of somebody who was banned and when the station was purchased is probably happening all over the country, and to hear it from somebody that is a, you know, it's very true. This is what your whole book is about and your career is about, Stephen, is exposing this truth so that we can be more empowered as consumers. So
right. It's very important, because I said, unfortunately, in this instance, the mainstream media has been acting as pliant accomplices, really, of a cover-up. And because when they're given the concrete evidence and they refuse to report it, they're complicit, because the media is supposed to be a watchdog on government fraud and wrongdoing.
But they haven't been given the concrete evidence, because, as you said, that was covered.
They have been given the concrete evidence, yeah, and they refuse to share it with the public.
But you said that was covered up.
Well, they were covered up until my lawsuit uncovered them. The lawsuit that was organized, that I initiated against the Food and Drug Administration, mm-hmm. forced it to divulge more than 44,000 pages of its internal documents. Mm-hmm. If that lawsuit hadn't been brought, we'd still be in the dark about what the FDA scientists actually said, because mm-hmm. You wouldn't know it from what the FDA said. The FDA claims we're not aware of any information showing that these foods differ in any uniform or meaningful way from other foods. That claim was made by an FDA official before the U.S. Senate Agricultural Committee just recently, and so that's what we're getting. When I say recently, I mean within recent years. I think that was actually in the fall of 2016. And
wow.
She was testifying. She made that claim. It's a false claim. It was false in 1992. It's even more false today. They have more information today than they did back then. But that's what they claim in public, and the media does not hold their feet to the fire. The media doesn't expose that lie, even though it's been given abundant evidence right from the FDA's own files that statement is not true.
Let's go back to our phone calls here. Lynn in Orange, California. Hi, Lynn. Do you have a question for Stephen Drucker?
I'm just a common person out there basically trying to understand the common sense to all GMO aspects and all the rhetoric. So I kind of go back to the basics, and I guess one of the most important things I don't hear you pointing out about for just the common person to grasp and understand the whole process of GMOs. The soil is like the gut. Like, human beings have a gut, and we have bacteria that have to balance us out to keep us healthy. Well, the soil also has that. And the fact that it hasn't been mentioned that GMOs kill mycorrhizal, which is the thing that keeps the soil healthy and working and happy. And so if you eliminate that aspect to the soil, you basically, through the herbicides, technically even fertilizers will do that, or man-made fertilizers. The fact that you literally are destroying soil and turning it into dirt. You can, you know, the gray stuff that we see pretty much all over, you know, the United States, that's dirt compared to soil, which is living. And if you put all these chemicals onto it and kill the living soil, then you basically have taken away the immune system to the soil, which then predators come in, and then you need pesticides that that are going to kill bugs and insects, including beneficials. So I don't hear anyone talking about that point of, like, we're literally killing
the soil. Soil. Yeah. Stephen, have you ever stated that in any of your lawsuits about the soil? Do you have any evidence around that?
Well, the lawsuit didn't talk about the soil, but my book, there's a chapter in my book on the environmental problems of genetically engineered foods, and so that issue is discussed, the fact that the increased spraying of herbicides and the pesticides that have been engineered into the crops are having a negative impact upon the living organisms that make up soil. Soil is predominantly, living microorganisms, various bacteria and fungi and other organisms, and there are many, many kinds of organisms that do contribute to the health of the soil and allow the plants to extract proper nutrients. And there is considerable evidence, and again, published in peer-reviewed literature, that through the genetically engineered crops, there have been negative impacts upon these organisms, one or another forms of the organisms. So yes, that's another problem, that there's a negative impact upon the microorganisms that contribute to the health of the soil and therefore to the health of the plants that grow in the soil.
Just to the point, someone should actually attack it from that point, because if you go and listen to Gabe Brown, who's a farmer in the Dakotas, he will give you plenty of evidence to the fact that if he has been a farmer doing over 5,000 acres, and in the process of doing those 5,000 acres over 15 years, he's literally become more profitable by not using, he's not certified organic, he's just simply gardening or farming the way that nature is supposed to happen. And in the process, he's created such good land now by not using any chemicals that his soil is now, it's drought resistant. It's absolutely completely drought resistant.
Fascinating.
It stores water that he literally can store the size of a local dam on his property that he farms. So you don't have to build a dam. He actually has the capacity to store like Mother Nature is supposed to store on his property. His next door neighbors floods out. His does not. The soil is supposed to absorb because it has all these living things in it that are a system that were someone created.
Amazing. What an interesting story. Thank you so much, Lynn, for sharing that. I appreciate that. And is there a possibility of the crops such as corn and soy to not be genetically modified, or has it propagated so much through wind and birds and seed exchange and so forth, Stephen? Are those crops permanently tainted? Are there any such thing as organic corn crops any longer, really?
Oh yes, there. Fortunately, there still is organic corn, but it's harder to grow that because, as you well stated, Lisa, that there's contamination of non-genetically engineered fields occurs through pollinators, through wind blowing the pollen. It's crops spread their pollen. And that happens. And corn spreads it to a greater distance than many other crops. So there has been a substantial contamination of farms that were trying to grow non-GMOs by GMO neighbors. But there are areas where corn can be grown that's free of the contamination, and it still can be organic and certified as non-GMO by the GMO-free non-GMO project. But it's becoming more and more difficult, and even the center of corn in the highlands of Mexico were discovered to have been contaminated. Corn there that was supposed to be pristine and protected, somehow there had been contaminated from GMOs that had been illegally planted one way or the other, or in one way or the other contamination did occur. So it's a very great problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more and more difficult to get canola that's not been contaminated by GMO or soy or corn. Those are the three largest crops that have been genetically engineered. And it's difficult, increasingly difficult, for farmers to keep their crops free of GMO contamination. But it can be done.
Wow. I mean, I would think that you would have to start small again and really protect and contain your crops. What about, is there any link that you've discovered between autoimmune disease and genetically modified foods?
Well, some people think that there could be. And since the advent of genetic engineering and since the appearance of genetically engineered crops on the market, autoimmune diseases and several other diseases have increased. The rate of incidence has increased. So there is, and some scientists have shown, that there's a correlation between the increase, you can track the increased presence of GMOs on the market and the increase of several diseases. But that's correlation, it's not causation. It would be very difficult to establish causation at this point. One would need long-term, one would need epidemiological studies, and unfortunately, because there has not been labeling, there have not been follow-up programs or monitoring programs in place, it would be extremely difficult and near impossible to try to do the epidemiological studies at this point because they haven't been set up. Consider the case of tobacco. Those studies were done over many years, and even though that there were good reasons to believe that tobacco was linked, smoking tobacco was linked to lung cancer or other problems, that data, the link to lung cancer, didn't come out until the mid-1960s. And so even in 1960, somebody could have claimed, and I'm sure industry was claiming, there's no evidence that smoking causes harm in any way. But the epidemiological studies had been underway, but the results were not at the state of being able to declare a link until the mid-1960s.
So it took a while. It took a long time. Yeah.
We knew who was smoking. They knew when they started smoking, how many cigarettes a day they had been averaging, and still look how many years it took to establish that link.
Yeah.
And in the case of GMOs, people don't know when they first started eating GMOs and which GMOs they've been eating in which proportions. So there's really no way to conduct those studies.
Yeah. And it could really be
designed that way with no labeling, no monitoring in place,
right,
to make it very difficult to establish a causal link between any particular GMO and any particular health problem.
It could be also many other environmental factors, and it could be water, it could be air pollution and contamination, it could be vaccines, it could be whatever.
It could all be contributing, or
yeah,
we don't know what it is. So it's a very difficult situation to try to figure out what is causing what problem, you know, what is causing what problem.
Mm-hmm.
And as you just mentioned, a whole range of other potential culprits. So
right,
it's difficult to assess the damage.
Yeah, we're going to take a quick break here, Stephen, and when we come back, we're going to continue with our callers. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. My guest is Stephen Drucker. He is the founder of the Alliance for Biointegrity. Let's go back to our callers here. We've got Susan, who's a first-time caller in Mississippi. Hi, Susan. How you doing?
Fine. How are you doing, Lisa? I've been wondering where you were.
We're in Los Angeles right now. I'm in the studio. So what is your question for Stephen?
Well, you kind of touched on it with the autoimmune thing. Mm. I have celiac, And ironically, you were just talking about the corn thing, which is one of the only things that I can eat.
Interesting. It's
And
interesting. Yeah. So, no other grains?
well, rice, rice and corn mainly are the only grains that, I can have. No wheat, rye, barley. And the fact he was just talking about the corn is still basically contaminated.
The
It's very
wheat
big
is
protein.
very contaminated, though, Stephen. Could you
It
talk a little bit about that? Because, I mean, you discovered that the FDA had covered up warnings from their own scientists. Were there any specific foods that they were warning about?
No, not at that time, because that was back in that was the scientists were issuing their warnings before the FDA released its policy in May of 1992. So they were trying to help get the policy in line with sound science and the law, neither which occurred. The policy, as I mentioned, violates sound science and the law and the U.S. food safety law. But so there were no specific crops that were on the market at that point, and they didn't warn about them. I would just state in the case of corn, it's possible to get corn that's, if it's certified organic, it's not supposed to be genetically engineered. But for an extra level of safety, if it's certified by the non-GMO project, it has to go through actually extra level of scrutiny. And so that if somebody has to eat a lot of corn and they're concerned about GMO, then that's the way to shop for corn ingredients, corn that has been certified that way. Now, of course, if you're buying corn on the cob in the supermarket, then you'd want to get the organic, and
And what
that's
about
not to be.
wheat? You were going to mention wheat.
Oh, well, wheat, there has been no, to my knowledge, no genetically engineered wheat on the market yet. There have been some test plots and things, so there could have been some escapes of which we're not aware.
I thought
But
all wheat was genetically modified.
no, the wheat has been, most wheat on the market has been hybridized, and that means they're modern hybrids. So that's crossing wheat within wheat, different varieties of wheat crossing with one another through sexually available pathways, just through pollination. So that's very different than genetic engineering
Wow.
using recombinant DNA technology, which is very unnatural and is not relying on pollination, on naturally available sexual reproductive pathways.
That's interesting. I thank you for your call, Susan, by the way. And I was, and this is just a, I don't have the study in front of me, but I was under the impression that in the 50s there was a movement to increase the food supply, and so then wheat had been modified to increase its yields.
Well, that was the development of strain or strains of dwarf wheat as part of the Green Revolution, and that was to the wheat varieties of wheat that wouldn't grow as tall, and more of the energy and the nutrient were concentrated into the to the grain itself to create a larger, head of the wheat, so that each stalk of wheat would be yielding more grain. But that was not accomplished through recombinant DNA technology. In fact, back in the 50s, recombinant DNA technology hadn't even been discovered and developed. That didn't happen until the early 70s, and it wasn't until the 80s that it could be successfully used to transform plants. So there's a lot of confusion because the proponents of genetic engineering keep saying they call it, they've started calling it genetic modification, and then they claim that, all crops have been genetically modified for centuries and centuries. But they were trying to lump just traditional breeding that occurs through pollen as genetic modification, as long as human beings were involved in one way or the other and in intentionally guiding the process. But that just misrepresents reality, because genetic engineering through recombinant DNA technology is a highly radical new technology that is not natural. It does things that couldn't occur through nature, and it entails a set of risks that do not happen through traditional breeding.
That's an interesting distinction. I'm really glad that you cleared that up.
Yeah, all it's right. Very important to clear that up.
Interesting.
That's another area in which the proponents have tried to muddle reality and convince people that genetic modification is essentially not anything really new at all, when it really is quite new and entails a unique set of risks.
Mm. All right, we do need to take another quick break, don't we? So we will be right back. Thank you, Stephen. This is Lisa Gari listening to Coast AM. Hello, welcome back to Coast AM. I am Lisa Gari, and my guest is Stephen Drucker. And we have a couple of callers about what you just stated here, Stephen, about the genetically modified wheat. Let's go to Ronald, west of the Rockies in Idaho. Hi, Ronald, how are you?
Hello, doing okay.
Good. What is your question for Stephen?
Well, I believe that this genetically modified wheat and all that have been happened long before he thinks. It was back in 1986 that I noticed the difference.
Are you a farmer, or in what way did you notice the difference?
Well, I grew up on a farm, but just by the texture of breads and how it performs to make bread. I used to eat a lot of breads before that, and it was really good product, but now you can't get a decent loaf of bread. The flours don't work. You can't make a loaf of bread anymore. It turns into, it's like taking sawdust and trying to make a loaf of bread.
It tastes like that to me as well.
Structure of it has all changed.
So, Stephen, you're saying that it was not genetically modified, but it was hybridized.
Yeah, because back in the mid-80s, there were no commercialized genetically engineered crops on the market at all. As I mentioned earlier, the Flavor Saver tomato was the first genetically engineered whole crop that came on the market. That didn't happen until 1994. So there have been changes to many varieties of wheat, but those have been accomplished through what is called conventional breeding. That's
if it was hybrid radiation
through either pollination, or there have been varieties of wheat that have been created through radiation technology, which creates one or another mutation that then gets selected for by the breeder. But those changes, you know, changes can be made. Genetic engineering is not the only way to make changes. In fact, up until quite recently, all the variation within crop plants was made through without genetic engineering, without recombinant DNA technology, but through different forms of breeding that are short of that. And Luther Burbank was creating many amazing new varieties of plants, but he wasn't using genetic engineering. He was just using his skill and intuitive powers, but again, using pollination just within the natural sexually reproductive pathways.
Mm. Interesting. Yeah, I mean, there are, and thank you very much for your call, Ronald. There are ways of combining, I spoke with a farmer who has cacao trees, and he married the vanilla bean that vines up the trunk of the cacao tree to create more of a vanilla flavored cacao bean, and David Wolf, and he created that. And that's not genetically modifying, it's just changing or marrying seeds, right? That wouldn't be considered genetically modified.
I mean, anytime a new human child is created, they have a unique genetic profile mm-hmm. that differs from either parents. But we can call that genetic engineering. That's natural variation,
right.
and nature is set up that way. You know, when that's how we get genetic diversity. That's how things change. So there are different combinations of genes that were already within that species' genome, But with genetic engineering, with through recombinant DNA technology, then new genetic material has been added to the genome of species that had never been there before and could not have been added through natural means. So that's a basic difference.
I see.
There's going to be genetic variation gained through natural means. And in fact, if there weren't genetic variation that occurs naturally, species would not be vigorous at all. So we need to have continual genetic variation in order to keep species in line with environmental challenges. And that's how, you know, that's how we keep species maintain robustness. It's through genetic variation, but that has been up until the advent of recombinant DNA technology. The genetic variation was primarily accomplished through sexual reproduction. But as I mentioned, radiation came into the picture after World War II, and some crops have been, new crops have been created through mutations created through radiation or chemical mutagenesis, but they're a small minority of crops. But I have to emphasize that with all of the natural variation that can be achieved, there has not been any documented case of a novel toxin being created within a conventionally produced food, a novel toxin that wasn't in that species beforehand. And in fact, an article published in 2013 in the journal Plant Physiology stated that although breeders recombine tens of thousands of genes with virtually infinite potential interactions, to our knowledge, there has never been a report of a completely novel toxin or allergen appearing in a genus as a result of conventional breeding. And therefore, the authors concluded that the likelihood of any novel toxin being created through traditional breeding is virtually zero. That's very different than the situation with genetic engineering, where we know not only is there a likelihood, but it has happened. Okay, that's been documented in laboratory that through genetic engineering, a new toxin entered a species that had never been in the species before. So that's a risk that is inherent with genetic engineering that does not exist in the case of conventional breeding. Mm. And it's a serious risk.
Steve, I want to go to one more caller here. We've got Virginia in Jacksonville, Florida. Virginia, do you have a comment or question for Stephen?
Yes, I do. I'm 85. Over the years, I have noticed a decline in the flavor of food. I remember before World War II, steak and chicken, the flavor of chicken. I thought it was my taste buds getting old, but I've talked to other people and they've all said the same thing. So it just, and I have a friend who raises cattle, and he said that they should be grass-fed and not thrown all this junk that they are just to put on weight to weigh more. There's also another thing I heard on the news only one time. I thought it was interesting. I thought they should carry it up on. Doctors operated on a patient, and when they opened up his stomach, they found he had little seedlings growing in his stomach. Now, it dawned on me that something similar had happened. I cut open an overripe tomato, and it had little, the seeds had germinated already. Now, I realize they treat them to keep them from spoiling, but I just, I don't know what to say. I just think that...
So the person had a plant growing inside of them?
It had germinated in his stomach. And I thought back to a few weeks earlier when I had cut open a tomato, and I do not eat tomatoes anymore because I stopped because they just don't have a tomato flavor like they mm-hmm. used to. So,
got to agree with you there. They yeah. are flavorless. I mean, flavorless strawberries, there's flavorless yeah. tomatoes out there. You can tell that the nutrient density is no longer there. And thank you very much for your phone call. I had a while ago done a research on a study that was conducted at UCLA saying that the nutritional content and iron of minerals in spinach of 1953 compared to 1997. There was a study done by UCLA saying that you would have to eat 43 bowls of spinach in 1997 to equal the iron and minerals found in one bowl of 1953 spinach. And it also showed that the 1997 spinach, the potassium content dropped by 53%, iron content dropped by 60%, and copper by 96%. These minerals are not present, basically. The body cannot absorb vitamins if the minerals are not present. So then it means that our food's nutritional density has definitely been compromised. I don't know if that's from genetically engineered food or compromised crops or radiation or compromised soil nutrients. It's definitely dropping, though.
All of those could be factors, but in the case of spinach, there's been no commercialized genetically engineered spinach, so there are other factors involved. In the case of strawberries, again, there aren't yet, fortunately, and hopefully won't be, any genetically engineered strawberries. So again, any problems with the nutrient density and the flavor of strawberries has to be attributable to other causes. And so genetic engineering is not the only way in which changes have been and are being made to our food supply. So it's difficult to isolate in every case what the variables are. But in the case of most foods, genetic engineering can be ruled out because there have not been commercialized varieties of those crops yet. So
which crops are?
Those are not attributable to recombinant DNA technology, but they can be attributable. You know, something else is going on with the depletion of the quality of the soil to lead to that. But there are many other reasons, ways in which our soils have been depleted.
Now, which are the most genetically engineered crops?
The main ones, the ones that can be found in most packaged and processed foods, are soy, corn, canola, sugar beet. Those crops have been genetically engineered to a very high level, in which upwards of 90% of those crops have now been genetically engineered. And up till now, there hasn't been any problem with most whole fruits, although Hawaiian papayas and papayas from some of the papayas from other parts of the world have been genetically engineered. The majority of the Hawaiian papayas that are on the market have been genetically engineered. But most, there hasn't been genetic engineering of other whole fruits that have come to market, except recently a genetically engineered apple has come to market, and there are more genetically engineered fruits in the pipeline.
Well, Stephen, we actually have to wrap up here, so I want to say thank you very much for being a guest tonight. Again, the book is called Altered Genes, Twisted Truth. Thank you so much, Stephen, for joining me this evening.
Well, thank you for having me as a guest. I enjoyed it.
You're welcome. And thank you to Lisa Lyon and George Nori and Tommy Danheiser, Gina Salvati, and Nathan Engineer here at Coast to Coast. And thank you so much for listening. And I, as always, will encourage you to stay aware. This is Lisa Garr, and thank you for listening to Coast to Coast AM.